Although it dates back to World War II, Sandia National Laboratories continues to make important contributions to the nation's national security. It's the source of research and development that aids the Pentagon in its nuclear mission and civilian agencies in energy, climate, and infrastructure security. Julia Phillips is Vice President and Chief Technology Officer of Sandia National Labs. She joins us now in studio to discuss their research agenda. Julia, good morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so let's start with a quick review of Sandia's overall mission.
Well, Sandia started its life as the engineering division of Los Alamos National Laboratory. Our responsibility was to basically enable the physics package developed by Los Alamos National Laboratory to become a weapon and be used for military purposes, but also to be safe and secure when it was not needed. Over time, that mission has evolved to include other national security missions that take advantage of the capabilities that we built up for the nuclear weapons program.
And so for which federal agencies do you work now?
Well, our primary customer, of course, is the nuclear weapons program. Responsibility for that resides in the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is a semi-autonomous part of the Department of Energy. We do other work for NNSA in nonproliferation and some other areas. We do work for the rest of DOE in energy programs. We do a great deal of work for the Department of Defense, the intelligence community, Department of Homeland Security, and smaller amounts of work for other federal agencies.
Oh, so looking at the big one, the defense, nuclear defense of the nation, it seems like we're retiring nuclear weapons rather than building new ones. So what are the challenges in keeping what's left going?
Well, there are many challenges. One of the things is that the nuclear stockpile we have today is at the oldest age that it's ever been. And there are some parts of those weapons that do need to be refreshed and upgraded from time to time. And technology has changed a great deal over the previous decades, and so basically bringing them more up to date in terms of the technology that is in those weapons that remains. Another challenge is that with fewer weapons, we really can't take very many out of the stockpile to take them apart, look at them, and really assess what condition they are in. And so we need new ways of actually determining the health and well-being, if you like, of the weapons that remain.
So how do you do that? How do you give them a checkup?
Well, there are many ways of doing that. One of them is, in a very selected manner, to take a small number of weapons apart and look at how they are doing. I mean, it would really be like having a very thorough physical or, as I've heard others describe, taking your car in for just a very major overhaul before you embark on a major trip. Then there are some other less invasive ways that you can examine the health of the weapons, which would be, for example, looking at comparable components that are treated in the same way that you treat weapons or under the same conditions that they experience when they are out there sitting in the stockpile.
All right, so tell us about the research and development area that you're in charge of. What are some of the main areas, and tell us the scope of R&D in the first place.
Okay, well, the scope of R&D at the laboratory is very extensive. It involves a significant fraction of the laboratory. Our capabilities really built up, of course, originally to support the nuclear weapons program. They have evolved very significantly over the years because, of course, the fields of research that we're involved in have evolved. One example is computing and information sciences, which back in the 50s was unrecognizable compared to what we do in that field today. The other thing is that the face of national security broadly has changed over time, so that, of course, we are still very concerned and our primary mission is ensuring the safety, security, and reliability of the nuclear weapons stockpile. But other national security missions have come to us over the years based on the engineering and science capabilities we have at the laboratory. And the role of research really is to look out at and slightly over the horizon to see what areas of research we should be in so that we are able to respond to national security challenges when they arise. One example of an area that we certainly weren't doing 50 years ago, but are doing very significantly now, is bioscience. That is an area that has become of increasing national importance, particularly post 9/11, as concern about biological weapons increases, maybe pandemics, that kind of thing, to the point where we realized we had to add that research capability to the ones that we've been doing as long as we've had a laboratory.
And I think that's something that is still very much not understood. Give us some examples of how Sandia has leveraged your traditional expertise into that newer world. I mean, make the case for why Sandia is at the cutting edge of this.
Okay, well, I will give you first a historical example where we've seen the impact, and then I'll maybe look a little bit more out into the future of the kinds of things that we are working on today. In terms of a past example, Sandia has had expertise in radar really as long as we've been a laboratory. It's absolutely essential for nuclear weapons. That radar technology is, of course, applicable to other defense systems as well. And over time, we have been engaged in business that requires us to really apply and hone our radar technology to the point where we realized that the radar technology and synthetic aperture radar, which is a type of radar in particular, was very valuable for some of the conflicts that we've been engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem is that radar, as it was configured at the time, was quite large, bulky, and very difficult to actually get into theater and use in a useful way. So using some of our discretionary research investments, we were able to develop that, miniaturize it, improve the resolution and so forth so that we could actually use it in theater, flying it on UAVs to look at situations. And according to generals that have appeared on 60 Minutes and the like, many lives, U.S. lives and others have been saved as a result of what we've been able to provide to the warfighter. So that is an example where we continue to develop, but the impact is already very clear. Other things that we are very interested in are, for example, the future of high-performance computing. We and our sister laboratories depend very strongly on very high-performance computing to certify and assure ourselves that the stockpile is safe, secure, and reliable. But we always are looking for additional computational power, whether it is for obvious national security applications such as that, or potentially for things like combustion and providing cleaner and more efficient engines. The way we have traditionally made computers is really reaching the end of the line. Basically, the individual devices are something like a few atoms in extent, and so there's a physical limit that we are reaching. We are looking at
Moore's Law is
this
kind
is
of
Moore's Law
end,
is
right?
Actually coming to an end, exactly. And so we are looking at the device level at what kinds of devices might actually enable us to make more powerful computers going forward. Another challenge with computing is that it uses a huge amount of energy. Your laptop gets very warm when you're using it and it's sitting on your lap. And so that's wasted energy. If we can make computers more energy efficient by improving the way we put the devices together, using more energy efficient devices and that sort of thing. So we are looking at new approaches to computation, whether it is quantum computing, which is something that we're very interested in terms of quantum information and how you do computations there, or perhaps mimicking the brain and the way it works, doing it in silicon instead of inside our heads.
By the way, we're speaking with Julia Phillips. She's Vice President and Chief Technology Officer of Sandia National Laboratories. So does that mean an organic brain would go into the computer or silicon would go into our heads?
We would hope neither of those would actually happen. The goal is in silicon or other comparable materials, we might actually make devices that function in a similar way that the neurons in your brain function. And one of the things to think about is that your brain does calculations, and it comes up with sort of shades of maybe, if you like. You either are very sure, but very seldom are you absolutely sure, or you're not sure at all, but very seldom are you totally in the not sure category. Whereas today's computers, it's either a yes or a no. And
sure.
So it's a really different way of going about computing things, and very challenging and exciting.
Interesting. I'm stuck on the idea of whether or not it's good for a computer to also be so ambivalent. I find it hard to make decisions. You know, if my computer's not saying yes or no, then maybe we don't do anything at all.
Well, one of the things that we're very interested in and doing research on actually kind of gets at some of that, where we are trying to make it easier for somebody actually looking at a computer screen to make good decisions. So if, for example, you have your radar out there in theater and somebody is staring at a computer screen and needs to make a decision, do you redirect troops or do you not redirect troops? You want them to be noticing the important things in the data and how you present that information to them so that they make the right decision very quickly is really important and something we're working on quite hard.
Julia, I want to change the tactic a bit. You're here in Washington. Just assess for me, when you are at Sandia, what the current state of support you feel from those insiders in Washington, from Capitol Hill, from the political leaders. Are they knowledgeable enough about the scientific challenges in front of the nation?
Well, I think you can never have too much scientific literacy, scientific knowledge among policymakers, whether they are in the executive branch, the legislative branch, even the judicial branch, although that doesn't enter in quite as much. And so I think that our role as scientists and engineers is very significantly to communicate to those policymakers sort of a language level that is appropriate and appropriate for a cocktail party, if you like, what it is we're working on, why we're working on it, why it is important. And, you know, we are not the policymakers. We don't pretend to be. But the hope is that if we can explain the technical basis and the importance of what we are working on clearly enough, then they will understand that and include that in their decisions.
And how do you know where Sandia leaves off and DARPA and the other labs such as Los Alamos and Livermore begin?
Well, in terms of the responsibilities that we have for NNSA and the nuclear weapons program, that actually is pretty well codified. And the Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories, our sister laboratories, have the mission space that involves the physics part. In other words, the part of the nuclear weapons basically that goes boom. Our responsibility is the engineering around that. And so actually, even if you look at a weapon, the space that we occupy and the space they occupy is physically separated and in terms of function, very separated. So we provide the guidance, we provide the controls that say go or no go, and we are responsible for the safety and security systems.
Julia Phillips is Vice President and Chief Technology Officer of Sandia National Laboratories. Julia, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.